If you consider that the spaceship Odin, due to the time shift in the dimensional channel, only returned to the normal universe 22.5 years later, around the end of 1967, near Aldebaran, with only a few weeks of onboard time, and then landed on Sumer with an Aldebaran space cruiser escort that was already waiting, then the media contact between the Vril Odin media on Sumer and the Vril media on Earth took place not only over a distance of 68 light years, but also between two time levels, one around 22.5 years earlier and one around 22.5 years later, that is between the already real present and a future that is only possible based on this. It is only thanks to the fact that all of these media originally came from the same earthly time level of 1945 that media contact was possible between them at all over a period of around 22.5 years. Presumably caused by the cosmic evolutionary blurring of all future possible time levels, but not immediately real like the present, the media contact between these two broke off after 2 years, which must have been around the beginning of 1947 in Earth time and, after Odin's dimensional channel journey, in the time-shifted Sumer time of 1969-70. Perhaps the media contact between the Earth in early 1947 and Sumer in 1969-70 broke off because there was another media contact between the Earth in 1969-70 and Sumer in 1969-70. A media contact between the Vril Odin media and presumably the female descendants of the earthly Vril media. As this media contact took place on the same time level, it was probably similar. Like with radio waves, was so strong and intense that it completely overlaid the one from 19,471,969-70 and thus broke off. The legitimate question now arises as to whether and when the space fleet from Aldebaran will come to Earth. Is there any evidence now that points to a relatively imminent arrival of this space fleet? Let us reconstruct what would happen if a whole fleet of huge interstellar spaceships, coming from the extra-spatial dimensional channel, moved into our normal universe at almost the speed of light in relative proximity to our solar system and then gradually slowed down to a fraction of the speed of light. First of all, we must realize that, let's say, at least one light year away from the Sun and the Earth, an armada of huge spaceships the size and mass of asteroids suddenly appearing in space at almost the speed of light will create a strong gravitational shock in space that could have effects not only in the peripheral region of our solar system, but also, in a weakened form, in the area of the Earth. These effects in the solar fringe area primarily affect the comet cloud located here, the Oort cloud, named after the Dutch astronomer Jan Hendrik Dort, who has so far postulated its existence purely mathematically, which extends into space at a distance of 2 to 7.5 trillion kilometers from the Sun, that is up to 3/4 light years. Behind the orbit of Neptune, between 5 billion and 2 trillion kilometers, is the inner comet cloud, and between the orbits of Uranus and Neptune, between 3 and 5 billion kilometers, is the Kuiper comet belt, named after the Dutch astronomer Gerard Kuiper. In these two comet clouds and the comet belt there are several trillion comets with a total mass of a maximum of 10 Earth masses. The so-called asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter is well known, consisting of spherical, atmosphere-less celestial bodies ranging from the size of a grain of dust to around 1,000 kilometers. About there are different calculations and estimates for the total mass of the asteroids, most of which are less than the mass of the Earth's moon. Perhaps this cosmic ring of dust and small planets, orbiting the Sun at a distance of around 450 million kilometers, represents the remaining cores of a former inner comet belt in a prehistoric solar planet system, or, according to an older theory, it is a small, still existing fraction of an Earth-like transmartian planet that burst apart in ancient times, the main mass of which was distributed over the course of eons to its former two neighboring planets Mars and Jupiter as small moons, or fell onto their surfaces, and also fell on a spiral trajectory ending in the Sun, partly onto the inner planet Earth, and on the Earth's moon, Venus and Mercury, devastating them. Mars becomes uninhabitable. Dinosaurs suddenly die out on Earth. The Earth-like, water-rich Venus becomes a planetary hell. Mercury gets a cratered surface like the Earth's moon. Both comets and asteroids from the asteroid ring experience significant orbital disturbances when subjected to strong gravitational influences from interstellar space, causing some of them to take a spiral orbit leading towards the Sun. On the solar planets, which are of particular interest to us on Earth, gravitational shocks from interstellar space lead to series of earthquakes and volcanic eruptions when sufficiently strong, accompanied by an above-average number of meteorites falling and meter-to-kilometer-sized asteroids approaching the Earth in a threatening manner. Well, this has been the case since the early 1990s, as one could read in all the newspapers, and even earthquake-proof areas such as Egypt were hit by severe earthquakes. Some meteorites within the Earth's atmosphere and asteroids near the Earth behaved more like small and large reconnaissance ships, like artificial and not natural cosmic objects. From 1990 onwards, earthquakes became more frequent all over the world, asteroids floated in everywhere, there were spectacular meteor sightings and meteor crashes that continue to this day. Based on the media report, one could now come to the conclusion that at least some of it is true or at least partially correct. Had a delegation of the Aldebarans perhaps already landed in the USA? And did they issue an ultimatum? Well, whatever the case, on October 3, 1990, Germany was reunified into a greater federal republic and just a short time later the USSR disintegrated into Russia and several partially warring, bankrupt states, leaving only the USA as a superpower. Coincidence? If all of these indications coincide with the arrival of the Aldebarans around 1990-91, then a light year, 9.46 trillion km, from the Earth, then we are in a position to roughly estimate and calculate the time span within which this space fleet from Aldebaran could reach the Earth. If the Aldebarans moved from the superspace dimension channel a light year from the Earth back to the normal universe in 1990-91, then they had to quickly slow down their almost light-speed flight, because an almost light-speed space flight of the entire fleet to Earth would not only devastate our solar planetary system as a result of the gravitational shocks generated by the spaceships in the highly relativistic speed range, but above all could possibly cause the target point Earth to burst, which would then create a second inner asteroid belt. The space armada would therefore certainly only advance to the Earth at a fraction of the speed of light. Here is a small table showing the speed at which the space fleet could arrive at Earth without endangering the Earth and at the same time not taking too long a journey if it starts about a light year away from our Sun. Departure in 1990-91 at 1/6 the speed of light equals arrival on Earth in 1996-97. Departure in 1990-91 at 1/7 the speed of light equals arrival on Earth in 1997-98. Departure in 1990-91 at 1/8 the speed of light equals arrival on Earth in 1998-99. Departure in 1990-91 at 1/9 the speed of light equals arrival on Earth in 1999-2000. Departure in 1990-91 at 1/10 the speed of light equals arrival on Earth in 2000-2001, etc. So much for Mr. X's comments. He had already written all of this down many years ago, independently of the experiences of the Faisal family. The fact that a small delegation of Aldebarans has been observing the Earth for decades from their various bases, for example the Moon, and spaceships, and at the same time contacting people, does not contradict the research and calculations of Mr. X. He was concerned with the possible arrival of an armada of Aldebaran spaceships, which are apparently of a size comparable to the spaceships from the Hollywood film Independence Day. But since it is not in the interest of the Aldebarans to take over the Earth and bring a solution from outside, which would not be one, it can be assumed that after their arrival they will behave passively in order to observe the further free development of the Earth's people. The question also arises, if the Aldebarans are really so advanced, whether they would not be able to travel in time, without a dimensional channel, which would make all these calculations superfluous. In this episode, only the Vril pilots used the dimensional channel, with their technology that was certainly outdated from the Aldebaran's point of view. If the Aldebarans were able to travel through time, or space-time, possibly bend or even fold space, they should actually be able to appear here at any time. So there are still some unanswered questions on this point. Chapter 17, Other Alien Bases on the Moon and Mars. During another trance session, Rayna saw an underground base under the pyramids on Mars. I would like to add the following to this. On September 2, 1993, a speaker on ORF, Austrian television, announced in the Science Today program that NASA had finally given up on the US Mars Probe Observer after it suddenly lost radio contact with the NASA Earth station near Mars on August 24, 1993. Since then, there has been no way of knowing what happened to the observer, or whether it still exists at all. The last images sent to Earth before its disappearance showed a shadow approaching the observer, after which there was radio silence forever, at least officially. What was this shadow? But in 1989, the Soviet probe Phobos 2 experienced something similar to the USS probe near Mars. Before Phobos 2 could land on the small Martian moon Phobos, after the probe had already transmitted a few Mars photos to Earth in Mars orbit, radio contact with it was lost forever for reasons that were never clarified. The observer was also supposed to research the face on Mars, a mountain-sized sculpture of a human face that was clearly created after a computer check and only visible from space, as well as the Martian pyramids in its surroundings. The explanation presented by NASA and various academic scientists that these are probably volcanic cones can only be seen as a bad joke. Unless you also consider the Egyptian pyramids to be volcanic cones, because at least some of these Mars pyramids are the exact counterpart of the Egyptian Cheops pyramid, enlarged several times. In one of the Mars pyramids, you can again see a perfectly rectangular interior. Which probably best proves the purely artificial origin of the Mars pyramids. Because not only exactly geometrically rectangular pyramid-shaped volcanoes, but also just as precisely geometrically rectangular volcanic craters simply do not exist. Even larger rock formations the size of a mountain range with equally exactly rectangular structures, which look like the foundations of a Titan metropolis, at least suggest that these are the ruins of a former Mars city. For the subject of the face on Mars, see the book and the excellent video film by Richard Hoagland, The Mars Connection. This must have even impressed NASA scientists, so that they named this mountain range Inca City, even if officially only ironically. However, US Mars probes not only photographed Titanic, quite obviously artificial structures on Mars and transmitted them to Earth, but also very small ones. Just a few days after the Viking I probe landed on Mars in July 1976, it transmitted a photo of its surface to Earth, which clearly showed a boulder with a B, G or 8 engraved or painted on it. Of course, the geologist's official explanation was as usual, it was the result of a natural shadow falling on the weathered rock surface. But the Americans were not the first Earthlings to make these discoveries on Mars. According to the documents of the Vril Company, made available to us by Mr. X, the first flight to Mars took place in the winter of 1944. It was with the Vril 7. The following can be seen from the flight report. 20. Exit after a laborious channel flight at computer point 20. The planet, Mars, is coming closer quickly, or rather we are closer to it. The light of the sun is still strong here. This side flight to Mars, duration 20 hours. It looks completely different from the Earth, approximately two lines illegible. An indescribably moving feeling grips everyone. Like the excavation of an incredibly old mummy, perhaps, which still has the memory of life, approximately 15 lines made illegible. A low-level flight from 30 shows uncomfortable-looking landscapes. No trees or other plants to be seen. Huge gorges and ring mountains. Extensive deserts. Often something like wide river basins, but without water. No real clouds, but now and again something like veils of mist. Everything seems pretty desolate and empty. Probably ice on some mountain peaks. But in the desolate emptiness there are ancient traces of buildings and sometimes very large ruins that are reminiscent of ancient Egypt, or the Aztec culture. In any case, as if they were built by humans. At some point a very, very long time ago, you would have to land to know for sure. Went down via point 30 and point 30, down to 1000 meters. The area here is really very flat. The ground seems to be solid, color ochre. Only a few cracks here, two circular holes at point 30. Diameter maybe 300 meters. It would be possible to fly into them. Holes seem to be deep. Distance from hole to hole around 2 kilometers. About 50 meters further, steeply rising mountains. Several crescent-shaped openings in the mountain walls, like large caves. Counted 14 such caves. Width between maybe 50 and 1,500 meters, height about 20 to 800 meters. Flying in seems possible. Behind point 30, crater-like depression with particularly steep walls. Different than usual. Horizontal surface below. Could be ice, maybe also salt crust. Diameter at the top, estimated 3,000 meters. Depth about 1,000 to 1,200 meters. Light ground surface, maybe 150 to 200 meters in diameter. Behind it, to the NNE, there is another large, smooth surface. Like an oversized motorway. On the right-hand side from the direction of flight, there are several, not entirely regular, pointed cones. All perhaps 100 meters high. 118 counted, all in a line. The area here has oddities. But no inhabitants, nothing that looks like life still exists here, but a lot that points to old times of inhabitation. For example, winding stairs on some of the slope walls, the steps of which can still be seen, or at least that's how it looks. Between point 30 and point 30 there are undeniably well-preserved ruins of large temples. One of the temples looks like it has been hit by a bomb. You can see inside. The walls are multi-layered with wide gaps, which are again divided into rooms by thinner walls. The middle temple hall is about a third filled with sand and dust, which probably covers a sanctuary, which is why we cannot see it. Although everything has been worn down by the ravages of time, it is unlikely that these are natural formations. A lake was discovered behind point 30, but there was no water in it. That was a misleading impression at first. Nevertheless, we think it was definitely a lake at some point. Near point 30. Strange mountain. From a distance, as if it were looking at you. Up close, however, it is just a mountain with at least two large eye openings in it, perhaps the face of Mars. Author's note. You can't see to the bottom. But there were probably once small, deep lakes. Here again, there are winding lines here and there that look like ancient paths. But not as even as at point 30. This could easily be natural. About two-thirds between point 30 and point 30, there is a place the size of a city that shows very strange traces. Almost like the last remains of foundations and streets. One of these streets is particularly noteworthy because there are still something like stumps of masts along both sides. But that could also be a natural formation. Just behind point 30, there is another city plan like this, but much larger, and at 30, another smaller one. There is even something there that looks like a tall, slender, broken tower or factory chimney, although it is certainly something else. At point 30 there is a collection of rocks that resembles a petrified forest. Went down to about 500 meters. The stone forest turns out to be a pure stone structure. Flew to point 30 again. Now at an altitude of 500 meters. Many oddities can be seen, but not quite identified. Of all the places we saw, 30 appears to be the best for a landing. Stay aborted after X hours. Did not land as ordered, although it would probably have been possible with our makeshift landing gear. Approximately 2.5 lines damaged beyond reconstruction. End. On the surface of Mars, clearly recognizable and unmistakable, and mostly enormous, remains of a once great human superculture can still be admired today. There are also objects on the Moon that are much less conspicuous and only partially recognizable as being of artificial origin. However, this seems to be a real playground for all kinds of round and elongated UFOs, as can be seen very clearly in several telescope and US Moon Expedition photos from the 1960s and 1970s. Some of these UFOs appear to be disc-shaped and bell-shaped in their external form and look suspiciously like the flying discs Hornbu 2 and Vril 1. On both the Moon and Mars, we can therefore assume that this human super-civilization of the time built extensive facilities under the surfaces of Mars and the Moon that enabled it to survive for at least a longer period of time. When the large bell-shaped, one-off spacecraft Hornbu 2i, named Thor, took off from Bergen to Mars on the night of April 21, 1945 and landed safely there, the crew may have moved into these underground facilities. A telescope photo from 1952 showing a UFO with the external shape of the Hornbu 2i flying over the nearby disk of the Earth's moon could possibly be an indication that the Mars spacecraft maintained a space shuttle service between Mars, the Earth's moon and possibly also on Earth with a landing base in Neuschwanland, Antarctica, at least at that time. Another telescope photo from 1951, in which a light cylinder with the moon in the background appears to float between the Earth and the moon, could mean that the long-distance cylinder spaceship project, which was only in the planning stage in 1945 and was known as the Andromeda device, was possibly assembled after 1945 in German Antarctic Neuschwanland from individual parts transported there before the end of the war. As a mother ship, the project was also able to transport Hornbu 2 and Vril 1 space disks. This is probably how the Hornbu 2 and Vril 1 UFOs photographed on the Moon by the US Moon Expeditions got to the Moon, because it is questionable whether Vril 1 disks had a range large enough for a moon flight. These space disks and the Andromeda device had and still have, as we have already learned, a type of electromagnetic anti-gravity drive. Both the Mars journey of the Hornbu 2i round spaceship and the stationing of the Hornbu 2, Vril I and Andromeda devices on the Moon shortly before and after the end of the Second World War may have had the purpose of reactivating the intact facilities under the surfaces of Mars and the Moon that the Vril Society suspected and then actually did exist, but perhaps they had already been reactivated by extraterrestrials? If that had been the case, it can be assumed that the crew of the Hornbu 2i was received and taken in by them. The fact that the USA abruptly cancelled NASA's manned Apollo program in the 1970s after a few moon landings and that no astronaut ever returned to the moon is a sign of the future. The fact that the astronaut was sent to the moon raises a lot of questions. What happened up there? Let's hear what the Swiss UFO expert Armin Rissi has uncovered. Namely what a NASA employee and an astronaut himself have to say about the first moon landing. Between 12 and the 14th of January 1997, Ticino Television broadcast a four-part UFO documentary. An uncut film of the moon landing was shown, in which you can see how the astronaut Neil Armstrong sets foot on the moon. His words can also be heard uncensored. Armstrong? Just got off, what is it? Do you have an explanation about that? NASA, Houston. We have won. Don't worry. Attend to the program. We have won. Don't worry. Keep following the program. Armstrong. Oh boy. It is really something. It's fantastic. You cannot even imagine this. Boy oh boy. That's really something. It's fantastic. You couldn't even imagine it. Houston. Roger. We know about that. You go the other way. Go back the other way. Roger. We know about that. You go the other way. Go back the other way. Armstrong. Well, if so kind. Really spectacular. Oh God, what is that? What is that? Well, if so kind. Really spectacular. Oh God, What is that? What is that? 204 Houston. Change frequency. Go Tango. Tango. Armstrong. If's a kind of life there, now. There is some kind of life there right now. Houston. Roger. Communication. Bravo Tango. Bravo Tango. Orc Jezebel. Jezebel. Roger. Communication. Bravo Tango. Speak Jezebel. Jezebel. Armstrong. But this is unbelievable. But this is unbelievable. Then the frequency was apparently changed. After this scene was broadcast, Dr. Dini, who was the guest on this program, was questioned. Dr. Dino Dini from Italy was a long-time NASA employee as an aerospace engineer and professor of energy and at the same time employed in intelligence. The moderator turned to Dr. Dini and literally confronted him. Mr. Dini, you worked in NASA intelligence. I ask you, why did NASA remove what was said directly from the official version that was circulating around the world? Why was it deleted? And he answered, to everyone's surprise. It was deleted because it brought together many things that belonged to this famous blue book that should have been published but was not. Well, the fact is this. What Armstrong saw was real. Because wherever there is confusion, in the Gulf War, in the last war, wherever there is confusion, these flying discs appear. These discs come from stations that are positioned near the Earth. So it was right and we had to do it. Moderator. You mean delete? Dini. Yes, delete. Moderator. You heard what was said. What did Armstrong see? What was that? Dini. He saw objects that followed them, spaceships that followed the Apollo. Moderator. Also living beings? Dini. Yes, also living beings. The Apollo space shuttle spaceships were followed by other spaceships. This is a fact that has been attested to by various expeditions. And ex-astronaut and elite pilot of the American Air Force Gordon Cooper explained to the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, the 15th of August 1976. Intelligent beings from other planets visit our world in an effort to make contact with us. I have encountered various spaceships during my flights. Both NASA and the American government know this and have a lot of evidence, which they are however holding back so as not to alarm the population. Source, UFO News Number 3 May, June 1997. Here again the dangerous question arises, who was actually sitting in these discs? With regard to the failed Moon and Mars expeditions, the possibility must be considered that the Aldebaranians have little sympathy for the USA and the former USSR. Let's see what newer expeditions will bring to light, perhaps recordings made in advance in the studio that are later sent live to Earth? Will there be sudden malfunctions or even complete losses again? It is also interesting the trainer was also led through tunnel-like structures in his hypnotic regressions, although he is now convinced that he was not always on board a spaceship, but probably also often in such underground bases. This could have taken place on Earth, but possibly also on the Moon or Mars. Chapter 18, Are the Aldebarans Our Ancestors? In another trance session, which took place with Peter, a friend of Feist, the following information came to light. We'll get back into the session at the point where it gets interesting for us. Raina. Yes, now I can receive something. Peter. What? Raina. Yes, they're there. Peter. Who? Raina. Inno and his friends are there. Peter. What do you mean they're there? Raina. You can't see them. They come in another way. Peter. Where are they? Raina. They're on the Moon, on the dark side. Peter. Why are they there? Exclamation mark. Raina. They have to be careful because the US government has a good defense system. They shoot at all spacecraft that come close to Earth. Peter. Is it a big problem for them? Raina. Laughing. No, but the USA has allies. It's an extraterrestrial civilization that works with the USA. Peter. Who is this civilization? Raina. It's the Capellans. They are not well disposed towards humans and have conducted experiments on them. But now they are no longer doing any. Peter. Are they dangerous to us humans? Reyna. No, we are protecting you humans. Peter. What are your interests here? Reyna. We are related to you. Peter. How are you related to us? Reyna. We are your ancestors. Peter. How far back was it according to our time? Reyna was shaken. Peter. What is going on? Reyna. I received an impulse. Peter. Can you answer the previous question for me? Reyna. We are your direct ancestors. 735,000 years of Earth time. Peter. Were you present on Earth? Reyna. Yes, we had founded a colony on Earth. Peter. What was your reason? Reyna.